series on Hosea, the heart and holiness of God, entitled, In Love He Came and Sought Her, for the call.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. We have a fairly hefty menu on the table here this morning as we try to do some of the introductory work, which is always the part, I think, that requires the greatest amount of attention at the beginning of a study. And once those details are fairly well grasped by ourselves, and we can warm up to the study with an understanding of the background and the time and place in which the prophet is speaking on God's behalf, we have a better feeling for all of our studies during the course of the week. And I don't like in the first class to try and labor historical material and background information too heavily. So we have produced for you a 5-page booklet that is meant to cover a lot of the historical background that you can take a look at in your spare time. And since I will not be laboring the historical background in any great detail, I'm hoping that you will be interested enough to take a look at the notes in your spare time, perhaps today in the next few days before the week gets too far along. I will be directing your attention to some of the highlights in those 4 or 5 pages this morning as it fits into our introductory comments. If there's anything in those booklets that seem rather difficult to understand, please see me sometime during the week and I will try to interpret or clarify any of the details I don't touch on in class. Our introduction then. The prophet Hosea and his times. First, a word about the importance of the prophecy of Hosea itself. Of the 12 minor prophets, so-called, Hosea is really not one of the better-known prophets. In our own lectures and Bible classes, in our own literature within the community, one finds more frequent reference to the so-called minor prophets, such as Jonah, Micah, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Those are the minor prophets that most of us hear about and think about perhaps the most. And yet, brothers and sisters, none of these minor prophecies just referred to, such as Malachi or Micah or Zechariah, receive anywhere near the same amount of New Testament reference, direct New Testament reference, as does the prophecy of Hosea. Now that sets for us a kind of perspective in terms of the importance of the book of Hosea, in terms especially of its New Testament usage, direct New Testament usage. Jesus, for example, quoted directly from Hosea on 2 occasions, both recorded in Matthew's Gospel. He alluded to Hosea's prophecy at least on 2 other occasions, according to the Gospel references. Except for Jesus' reference to Daniel regarding the abomination that maketh desolate, the Lord's reference to Hosea is really rather unique, because Jesus specifically commends his listeners, when he quotes Hosea, to go back and read the source of his quotation from Hosea. Now that underlines the importance, in the Lord's estimation, of what he was trying to say from the message of Hosea. When he quotes Hosea in Matthew chapter 9, breaking into the quotation, he uses the key phrase, again only a few chapters later in Matthew, I will have mercy and not sacrifice. Go back and read what it meaneth. Which must obviously mean, don't just go back to Hosea chapter 6 and read the verse that I've quoted from. Be sure, listeners, that you understand the whole context of that chapter. And perhaps also, the Lord is intending that we understand the total message of Hosea, which was so pitifully neglected amongst the rulers that he was talking to in his ministry. Now, that kind of quotation, that kind of direct reference to such a prophet as Hosea, with the commendation going with it that we should go back and read what it means, is really a unique commendation by the Lord for the source material that was being used in his teaching of the New Testament. And it certainly stresses for us the importance of understanding where the Lord was quoting from in Hosea, and perhaps it should encourage us this week to appreciate the wider context of the Lord's quotations in the ministry. Hopefully, a feeling of the whole prophecy itself will help us to better understand and to have done our homework according to the Lord's advice. The Apostle Paul, brothers and sisters, draws upon principles from Hosea twice in a passage in the book of Romans. The Apostle Peter, in his epistles, refers to Hosea no less than three times, possibly five in total. So that an awareness of the New Testament references to Hosea should encourage us to a study of Hosea. There must be something there in that prophecy that is rather unique, and certainly something that should demand the attention of New Testament readers trying to understand their Lord's teaching and the understanding of the epistles themselves. Next, we could move to the dating of the prophecy itself. Now, at this point, if we had our eye on Hosea chapter 1 and verse 1, we would better appreciate some of the comments we're only going to briefly make this morning, and hopefully your booklet will expand and clarify any additional details. Hosea chapter 1, verse 1 gives us, from Scripture itself, the historical setting of the prophecy. And it's quite specific. The word of the Lord, verse 1, that came unto Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. Now, we should be alerted immediately to the way in which those time frames are set. We have listed for us in chapter 1, verse 1, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, four kings from the south, from the southern kingdom of Judah. We have one king, Jeroboam, and really that's Jeroboam the second, to be specific. Jeroboam the second, the son of Joash, being listed as a king of the north, a king of the northern kingdom of Israel at the time of Hosea. Now, what's interesting, right off the start, Hosea is really a prophet sent to the northern kingdom. And yet, in chapter 1 and verse 1, he gives greater attention to the kings of Judah in setting the context of his prophecy than attention to the northern kings. And there were many, not many, but at least were another half a dozen after Jeroboam. He is a prophet sent to the north, but greater attention is given to the kings of Judah than to the kings amongst whom he prophesied as a minister to the north. That's rather interesting and perhaps a little puzzling at first. We hope some of our comments as we go through the week will clarify why that perhaps is so. The dates of the kings, if you turn to the first page in your booklet with the chart there before you, the dates of the kings referred to here in chapter 1 and verse 1 really cover a period beginning from, let's say, Jeroboam II till the end of the Judean king of Hezekiah, a total of about 105 years. Of course, that would be assuming that Hosea began in the first year of Jeroboam II and continued until the last year of Hezekiah. That is really not so, but if it was, it would span about 105 years of Israel's history in total. From various clues within the prophecy, most Bible commentators, most students within our own community would agree that it is highly likely that Hosea really prophesied actively for about 70 years of ministry. Total possibility of 105, but really it probably narrows down to about 70 years of actual active ministry in Israel. Another point of interest, to put things in perspective, the bulk of Hosea's prophecy really seems to have been delivered a little later than Amos, just a little later than that of Amos, and a little earlier than that of Isaiah and Micah. That puts, again, a kind of context around our prophecy. And like Amos, Hosea's words were directed almost entirely to the northern kingdom. First, it was seen in the last years of the prosperous reign of Jeroboam II. That's the last years of Jeroboam II, which is most likely. The time there would be somewhere between 780 and 740. And then during the years of confusion and bloodshed in the north, which followed Jeroboam's death, up to just before the fall of Samaria, when it fell to the Assyrians in 721. So he couldn't possibly have been prophesying any later than 721, because the capital of the north has fallen by that time, and the north really has crumbled in the hands of the great Assyrian lion. So we have a kind of context there. We look again at our chart, and we can make some other comparisons which help us to be prepared for the context in which the prophet is working. The chart shows us that Isaiah overlaps the period of Hosea. If Hosea prophesied during the time of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, then obviously he's a contemporary with Isaiah. Because when we go to Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 1, we discover that he too covers the same kings. We discover that Micah is a contemporary, at least for some of the years, during Hosea's ministry. He prophesied during the time of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. It also brings in, as a contemporary prophet, working at the same time, the prophet Amos, who prophesied during the time of the first king mentioned in Hosea 1 verse 1. Now we've already said, looking now to the right-hand side of your first chart, that Hosea only mentions one king of the north, Jeroboam II. Who was deleted? There were also contemporary kings in the north with Hosea. Who was deleted? Well, we've listed them for you just for context. He does not mention Zechariah. He doesn't mention Shalom or Menahem or Pekahiah or Pekah or Hoshea. But they undoubtedly were contemporary with the prophet's ministry. Now, in a total picture, Hosea is prophesying at a time of intense prophetic ministry in Israel's history. Some of the greatest prophets of Israel's history, whether we call them major or minor, are operating to the north or the south at the same time as Hosea. It's a rich period prophetically. I wonder why. Really, the answer is obvious from the time frame as we see on these charts. Here was a time in Israel's history when the northern 10 tribes were on the eve of their destruction. And typical to God's grace and care for his people, he is stretching out in a kind of concentrated prophetic ministry over a period of about 120 years, one prophet after the other, and some overlapping each other, a ministry to the tribes, to the north, warning them that the eve of destruction is around the corner, are reaching out, as it were, prophetically, to the small remnant within those 10 tribes that would listen, and to the south, a warning of what is coming to the north, a warning that the same consequences don't fall on the south as well. A concern, we'll see in Hosea, for those southern tribes that were the bastion around God's resting place around Jerusalem. God was concerned about Judah and Benjamin, that they be not the fools that the north has been for the previous few hundred years. A concern then for the remnant in Judah and Benjamin, that they preserve the holiness and the righteousness which was still there in part. Now that then shows us that these are rather interesting times in which the prophet is working. And Hosea is not like an Elijah, a voice crying in the wilderness. Many voices are converging at the same time in the north and in the south. The people really then weren't with any excuse at all, were they? Not only is Hosea appealing to the people, but Isaiah is appealing at the same time. And the great prophecies of Isaiah concerning the suffering servant and the coming of the Messiah and the prophecies of the coming kingdom that we quote from Isaiah 2 and Isaiah chapter 11. The great prophecies of the rest and the peacefulness in the future age are all coming forth at this time from the lips of Isaiah. Likewise from Micah, and likewise the dire warnings are coming forth from the lips of Amos. Many voices with a common focus, to the north and the south, appealing to the remnant to listen to God and to avoid the imminent destruction. It's an interesting time then. And a study of Hosea should open our understanding for the times in which these other prophets are working. And hopefully by the end of the week, we'll come away with a better understanding, not only of Hosea, but of some of the contemporary expressions found by the other prophets working at the same time. Some other clues within the prophecy itself that kind of makes for a good Bible detective exercise. What clues are there within Hosea that are time clues as to when, within this span of 100 or so years, Hosea is actually applying his ministry? Let's just look at the following passages quickly within Hosea. Time indicators. Well, first of all, notice chapter 1 of Hosea and verse 4. This is important as a time indicator. And the Lord said unto him, call his name Jezreel, the first son born to Hosea through his wife Gomer. For yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, and will cause to cease, notice it's future still, will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. Now, of course, that occurred in 721 when the Assyrians came down and took the city of Samaria and seized the northern 10 tribes. That was the end, and that's, of course, the future destruction referred to in verse 4. That then is still future to Hosea's prophecy. But notice also in verse 4 the reference to the fact that it is yet only a little while when God will bring his vengeance upon the house of Jehu. The house of Jehu? How is that a time indicator? Would you turn in your notes now to page 4? This is referring really to a prophecy in the Kings. We quote within our little box here on page 4 what we just read from Hosea 1 verse 4. For yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu. This relates to 2 Kings chapter 10 verse 30, and we quote, and the Lord said unto Jehu, because thou hast done well in executing that which is right in mine eyes, and hast done unto the house of Ahab according to all that was in mine heart, thy children of the fourth generation shall sit on the throne of Israel. And the four generations are listed for you there. Jehoahaz, Joash, Jeroboam the second, who is listed in Hosea 1 verse 1, who was obviously still on the throne when Hosea is giving part of his ministry. And the last son, Zechariah, not mentioned in Hosea 1 verse 1, but certainly a contemporary for part of the time. And the note at the bottom of our page, we notice then that from the time of speaking, Hosea 1 verse 4, the Lord had still not dealt with the house of Jehu. It was still yet a little while, and that would then suggest that Hosea 1 verse 4 was uttered at a point at least close to the end of Jeroboam the second's reign. Was probably not uttered during the time of Zechariah, because his reign only lasted 6 months. Now there's a time clue. It would seem then that if the house of Jehu has still not yet been destroyed, but it is just a little while, we must be somewhere in the time of the reign of Jeroboam the second when part of his prophecy is uttered. And perhaps it's just overlapping slightly on the time of Zechariah. We said his reign really only lasted 6 months, so it's somewhere close between number 3 and 4, time-wise. Well, there's one time clue within Hosea as we pursue a little bit of Bible detective work. Are there other time clues within the prophecy itself? Well, there are. Let's just consider another passage in the prophecy. Would you turn over, brothers and sisters, to chapter 13 this time? The kind of details that all of us overlook when we're doing our readings. But the prophet is dropping definite time clues that help us get the context and the setting of the prophet's work. Notice this one. It's quite obvious when you consider what it implies. Chapter 13 of Hosea. And we're going to look at verse 16. Samaria, now that's the capital of the northern 10 tribes, we remind ourselves, Samaria shall become desolate, for she hath rebelled against her God. Now, if Samaria was destroyed by the Assyrians in 721, and this is still yet future, according to Hosea's prophecy in chapter 13, we must be at least somewhere prior to 721. That sets at least another kind of boundary or time limit for ourselves. An important clue in the prophecy itself. Now, let's go to the kings. 2 Kings chapter 15, and we'll pursue a little bit of detective work there. 2 Kings chapter 15. This records for us the invasion of the Assyrians as they came down and took these northern 10 tribes and took Samaria, which Hosea is prophesying in chapter 13, being yet future. So, 2 Kings chapter 15, a very important passage in the king's record. We notice the following details. Verse 29 of 2 Kings 15. In the days of Pekah, you might want to have your eye on the chart of the first page of your booklet to see where Pekah is and how he fits in terms of time. The more we get used to this, perhaps, during the course of our classes, the better we'll become at it, and the more the historical details will make their impression on our minds. Pekah, there he is. About 740 to 732, about a 12-year period of reign. We see that from our first chart. All right, we resume our quotation. Verse 29. In the days of Pekah, king of Israel, came Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and took Ijon, and Abel-Beth-Maachah, and Genoa, and Kedesh, and Hazor, and Gilead, and Galilee, all the land of Naphtali, and carry them captive to Assyria. And verse 30, Hoshea, the son of Elah, made a conspiracy against Pekah, the son of Remaliah, and smote him, and slew him, and reigned in his stead. In the 20th year, now getting us the Judean contemporary, in the 20th year of Jotham, the son of Uzziah. The rest of the acts of Pekah and all that he did, behold, they are written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel. There is recorded for us, from Scripture, the northern invasion of the Assyrian. And we notice in verse 29 that he takes the northern boundaries first. Galilee to the north is taken. Hazor is taken. Gilead to the east, of the Jordan, the area of Gilead. Some of the tribes such as Manasseh, the half-tribe of Manasseh, such as Reuben and Gad. All of those tribes were in the eastern side of the Jordan, called Gilead. So it's the boundaries to the north and to the northeast that the Assyrian invader takes. All of that must still be future to Hosea chapter 13. Now, we notice in this king's account the fact that Gilead is taken in the course of this early invasion before Samaria, the capital city, is actually taken. And we also notice, as we go through Hosea's prophecy, that Gilead is mentioned, and Gilead is mentioned as still being, in a certain sense, free, and still exercising its foolishness. So if Gilead is still doing that in Hosea's prophecy, then we are not only prior to 721, when Samaria was finally taken, we must also be prior to 2 Kings 15 and verse 29. Because this area of Gilead was taken prior to 721 as a kind of initial invasion. Hosea talks about Gilead as still being wicked and yet still being free to be wicked. So that hasn't occurred yet. So we're pushed back year by year, even would seem perhaps 10 years before 721 as being another kind of boundary mark within which the prophecy must be set. All of those are historical details, but they show us how a prophet itself can give us very important time clues, and how our readings in the Kings and our readings in the Chronicles, which often seem to be dry reading, are very, very helpful sometimes in shedding some light on the details of the minor and major prophets. We should use the Kings and Chronicles as a key that way to help us before we go outside of the biblical text itself. Well, we notice in the king's account here, back to verse 8, 2 Kings 15. Verse 8, another important detail. 2 Kings 15, in the 38th year of Azariah, king of Judah, did Zechariah the son of Jeroboam reign over Israel in Samaria 6 months. Rather a short reign. We go down further here. Verse 10. And Shallum the son of Jabesh conspired against him and smote him before the people and slew him and reigned in his stead. Now go down to verse 14. For Menahem the son of Gadai went up from Tirzah and came to Samaria and smote Shallum the son of Jabesh in Samaria and slew him and reigned in his stead. We notice verse 25. But Pekah, the son of Remaliah, a captain of his, conspired against him and smote him in Samaria in the place, in the palace of the king's house with Argob and Ariah and with him 50 men of the Gileadites. And he killed him and reigned in his room. Now there we have another perspective as a setting in Hosea's reign. We've just gone through Zechariah, Shallum, Menahem, and we've mentioned now finally Pekah. Those are all contemporaries, according to your chart on the first page, all contemporaries of Hosea. In other words, Hosea lived at the time of that kind of turmoil. One king after another wading through blood to slay and to usurp a king on the throne. Kings reigning for the course of only 6 months, or a year, or 2 years, or a short reign such as 10. Political turmoil, bloodshed, and violence are marking the age in which Hosea is prophesying, and it's occurring in the north. The very arena in which Hosea is speaking his prophecy. So when we see those kings, Zechariah, Shallum, Menahem, Pekahiah, and Pekah, let them not be barren of some significance. Those short reigns are short because of the internal strife and instability that is marking the times of the prophet Hosea. A violent period. A period when, and it's no wonder Hosea gives no recognition to them beyond Jeroboam II, when king after king is acting like a violent beast to his neighbor. No thought or concern for the fact that the predecessor has been on the throne of the Lord. That he has been a man, howbeit how wicked, who is standing at least for some regal authority. So authority is being despised. The times are turbulent and there's a lot of insecurity. Howbeit, there is a lot of prosperity. How do we know that there has been a lot of prosperity? Well, Amos is a contemporary, is he not, with Hosea, especially in the early part of Hosea's reign? What if we were to go into the prophecy of Amos, brothers and sisters, and see whether or not the prophet himself gives us any clues about what the times were like for himself, for Amos? If he gives us some clues, then we also have some clues for what it was like at the time of Hosea. Would you turn in your booklets now, then, to pages 3 and 4? This is, as it were, the third point that paints the picture of background for us in concerning the time of the prophets. The blue sheets, pages 3 and 4, draw mostly from Amos. Now that's valid because he's a contemporary, as we've said. The reason we draw mostly from Amos rather than Hosea is because there are more clear statements in Amos's prophecy about society than there is in the prophecy of Hosea. Hosea talks a lot about judgment, talks a lot about a religious apostasy, talks a great deal about God's judgments and punishment as a result. But Amos has far more of a clearer picture of the society in which Amos and Hosea were actually living. Now let's pick up the clues. The quotations on pages 3 and 4 are all from the New International. I do believe That translation here captures very powerfully the graphic language describing the times in which Hosea and Amos lived. First, we note in our notes, it was a period of wealth and ease, despite the political turmoil and the violent bloodshed we've just noticed in the Kings. And the proof for that, brothers and sisters, notice these quotes from Amos. Chapter 3, I will tear down, says Amos, the winter house, along with the summer house. The houses adorned with ivory will be destroyed, and the mansions will be demolished. You lie on beds inlaid with ivory, and lounge on your couches. You dine on choice lambs and fatted calves. You strum on your harps like David, and improvise on musical instruments. You drink wine by the bowlful, and use the finest lotions. But you do not grieve over the ruin of Joseph. Amos 6 and Amos 3. It was also an age of oppression and indifference. We've already seen that from the internal strife amongst the kings that we've just read about in 2 Kings. But clues from Amos? Well, look at chapter 5 and chapter 2. Amos 5, for I know how many are your offenses and how great your sins. You oppress the righteous and take bribes, and you deprive the poor of justice in the courts. Amos 2, speaking of the north, they sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. They trample on the heads of the poor as upon the dust of the ground and deny justice to the oppressed. It was also a time of apostasy and political turmoil. Now directly from Hosea 6, I have seen a horrible thing in the house of Israel. There Ephraim is given to prostitution, and Israel is defiled. We turn over. Hosea 7 and Hosea 4. Further clues that indicate the period of apostasy and political turmoil. It says they devour their rulers. All their kings fall, and none of them calls on me. Ephraim is joined to idols. Leave him alone. That's a warning to the south, especially. Now, notice, brothers and sisters, if you will, that quotation from Hosea chapter 7 and verse 7, and see how it illuminates 2 Kings chapter 15 that we just read a few minutes ago. Menahem, Shalom, Zechariah, Pekah, one after the other, usurping each other's authority. Internal strife and bloodshed, wading through the blood of the previous king, as it were, in order to stab the next king and push him out of the way. Hosea is commenting in chapter 7, verse 7, on that very context of 2 Kings 15. The whole passage in Hosea 7 now should be illuminated, what he's getting at. They devour their rulers. All their kings fall. One of them lasts for 6 months. Another lasts for 2 years, another only for 10. And none of them calls on me. Is there any wonder, brothers and sisters, that after Jeroboam II, the prophet fails to make any mention of any other kings to the north, although there were still another half a dozen? They weren't worthy of scriptural mention. They were usurpers, anyways. They won their position by bloodshed, not by divine right. They were ungodly and abusive rulers. Political anarchy, apostasy, turmoil, a time of oppression, when the rich got richer and the poor got poorer and were sold for a pair of sandals. A period of wealth and ease, lying on beds of ivory, eating the fatted calves, strumming on the harps like David, drinking wine by the bowlful. Their sins mounted and the oppression continued. And the rich got richer and the poor got poorer. 6 successors, 4 dying violent deaths, all in the course of only a few dozen years. That is the time in which our prophet is ministering to the people. There we have pictured for us in lurid detail from the Kings and from Amos and from Hosea himself the time in which this prophet is appealing to the degenerate vine of Israel, as he called them. Were these people righteous? No, they were not. Was it easy, ecclesial work to do the shepherding in those days? It was not. Was one really jeopardizing his own life to speak the word of God and to run a Bible class? It was. It was in peril of life that Hosea spoke the words he did. Were the rulers good examples? Were there good elders in the ecclesia? There were not. Israel was barren and fruitless at the time that Hosea labored. Was there any reason for hope? Any reason for positive concern for the people? That's a question we'll leave unanswered until we go a little bit further in our studies. That's an important question. Was there any reason for hope? When we consider back home, brothers and sisters, the ecclesias from which we have left, the CYCs or the Bible classes that we have left temporarily, our mind's eye may travel back there for a moment, and we may know that over the past few years or weeks or months, there has been dissension, perhaps, within our ecclesia. There has been maybe strifes of words, perhaps words of unkindness. Maybe we've been aware of lethargy in our own ecclesia, a kind of blasé attitude to ecclesial commitments. Perhaps we have been aware of a billing campaign in which only two or three turned out. Perhaps we're aware also that there's a poverty of Bible knowledge amongst our young people, or perhaps within the ecclesia itself with the older ones. Do we have ecclesial problems in which we minister? Do we feel that we are in Elijah, as it were, in the midst of people that perhaps aren't very supportive? Do we feel that way? How did Hosea feel? How did Isaiah feel? How did Amos feel? What was the context in which those mighty prophets worked? They didn't have anywhere close to the kind of security and the kind of strength within their own context that we find no matter how weak our ecclesia. So there's a tremendous exhortation of practical value as we look at Hosea's prophecy during this week. These are oppressive times in which these prophets are working. There are very, very few to whom they really are appealing. Most of the nation has a heart that has clenched itself tight. And the poor and the downcast and the oppressed hardly have the wherewithal to be able to listen to the prophet, let alone respond in a positive way. And the rich and the arranging board and the elders are quite decisively apostate. So, perhaps we can more keenly empathize with Hosea's challenge to go forward with Isaiah and his contemporary prophets and bring the word of life to a degenerate vine, to a fruitless and barren nation, very much like what Jesus found, of course, when he came to Israel in his ministry. If we look in our notes to find some indication as to the structure of the book, now we're coming closer to our text itself, we look at page 2. We have to make a few honest admissions when we try to analyze the structure of the book. Because before we comment on anything expositionally within Hosea, we should try to understand what we're saying from Hosea within the structure of the book itself. First, we notice, and this certainly isn't the last word on how to divide Hosea up into sections, we notice there's a dark, heavy line towards the first third of our chart. Now, that indicates that the prophecy of Hosea falls fairly neatly into two broad sections. Chapters 1 to 3 involve the parable, the enacted parable between Hosea and his wife, Gomer. In that sense, the first three chapters are a type of personal narration. The second part of the book begins in chapter 4, verse 1, and runs to the end of the 14th chapter. Characteristically, that section deals with the clearest descriptions of apostasy and judgment, and God's appeal for restoration and national resurrection. And there we've said, The second part of Hosea is mostly national in scope. We're dealing with the total nation in its sins and weaknesses and in God's appeal for restoration. The sections are subdivided into smaller areas. I'm not going to comment on those, but to some extent we're arbitrary. The second part of Hosea from chapter 4 to 14 is very difficult to divide up in a nice, neat package in sections. There really seems to be something like Jeremiah's prophecy here, where a structure in the second part isn't really all that obvious. There are what we would call sundry exhortations and sundry admonitions, and they don't seem to gel together as a whole unit. There are some possibilities for structuring the second part, and they are there on your chart. When we then begin our analysis of Hosea in our class tomorrow and the last few moments that we have this morning, we're going to be dealing with section one. That is, the first three chapters that are quite personal and are dealing with the narrative part of the prophecy. Let's just begin in Hosea chapter 1 rather briefly. And it will be brief, as we'll have to finish shortly, and then we'll resume the first section tomorrow. Hosea chapter 1. Let's notice the story, as it were, that the prophet is based on. The experience of Hosea with his wife. Chapter 1, verse 2. The beginning of the word of the Lord by Hosea. And the Lord said to Hosea, go, take unto thee a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredoms. For the land hath committed great whoredom departing from the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, which conceived and bare him a son. And the Lord said unto him, call his name Jezreel. And he tells the prophet why the name Jezreel is given. We notice in verse 6, two other children are born. Whether they're born to Hosea proper is another question. We'll answer that tomorrow. Verse 6. She conceived again and bare a daughter. And God said unto him, call her name Lo-Ruhamah, for I will, and this is the meaning of her name, I will no more have mercy upon the house of Israel. It's no wonder, is it, concerning all the background we've just covered. But I will utterly take them away. But I will, verse 7, have mercy on the house of Judah, and will save them by the Lord their God. Verse 8. Now when she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and bare what is now the third child. Verse 9. Then said God, call his name Lo-Ami. For, here's the reason for the symbolic name, ye are not my people, and I will not be your God. Chapter 2. Say ye unto your brethren. Now, he's not talking to Hosea. He is talking really to Israel nationally. Notice that. Say ye unto your brethren, Ami, and to your sister, your sisters, Ruhamah, plead with your mother. Plead, for she is not my wife. Now, this is God speaking, so he's now talking about his wife Israel, which Hosea and Gomer were meant to portray. Plead with your mother, Israel. Plead. For she is not my wife, neither am I her husband. Let her, therefore, put away her whoredoms from out of her sight, and her adulteries from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked, and set her as in the day that she was born, and make her as a wilderness. So it's Israel being described. And set her like a dry land, and slay her with thirst. For I will not have mercy upon her children, for they be the children of whoredoms. For their mother, Israel, hath played the harlot, just like Gomer did. She hath conceived them, she that hath conceived them hath done shamefully. Now, there is the opener, the kind of scenario of the whole prophecy. Hosea experiencing a marriage breakdown with Gomer, meaning to portray the marriage between God and Israel. Turn now to your last page of the notes as we make our last comments. The yellow page. We'll turn to this again, but this will be an apt summary and graphically describe these two chapters. It's an enacted parable, brothers and sisters. We have God being represented parabolically by the prophet Hosea. She bare him at first a son. Hosea 1 verse 4. Israel, the bride of God, is being portrayed parabolically by Gomer. God, represented through Hosea, Israel, represented by Gomer, have a son, the firstborn, whose name is Jezreel. Now, literally, that means in the Hebrew, God sows, or it could mean God scatters. There's a play on that. Over to the right, we notice that she bore children, and they are, Hosea 2 verse 4, the children of whoredoms, and their names are pejorative. Lo Ruhamah, Lo Ami, not having obtained mercy, not my people. And we are told that they are the children of whoredoms. An enacted parable, indeed, meaning to portray for us some of the deepest emotions that a man could ever feel, that God could ever express in his bride that has left him. Tomorrow we find that bride, and we examine the true import of that parable.